This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. We stream at the same time we broadcast at prairiepublic.org. And joining us today to talk about something interesting, I think, to a lot of people and somewhat troublesome as well, collaborative divorce. And we're going to talk with a couple of members of the law firm of Parvey, Larson & McLean Family Law. And Shannon Parvey joins us.
Yes, hello.
And she's an attorney with the firm, and Kimberly Larson's name is also up there.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having us.
Well, let's begin with you, Shannon. What's the definition of a collaborative divorce?
A collaborative divorce, that's perhaps a more loaded question than you realize.
I think so.
Kim and I were just talking about that on the way over here. A collaborative divorce is something different than just the word collaborative. I think a lot of people perhaps think in divorce, perhaps attorneys collaborate sometimes or parties do. But a collaborative divorce is actually a term of art. And it means that at the outset of a divorce, parties are agreeing to stay out of the courtroom, stay out of the litigation process, and dedicate all of their efforts and energies and time and resources to reaching an agreement. So a collaborative divorce at its core is different because it involves typically a team of professionals, two parties who are going through a divorce, and they will each have their own attorney, as well as often the involvement of a divorce coach, a child specialist, a financial specialist, and sometimes other people who are needed, like appraisers or business valuators, things like that along the way. But that core team is set up at the very beginning of a divorce to help this family, help this couple through the process in a more mediated way, more sort of reasoned way, and a gentler way, perhaps, than the litigation route.
Kimberly, Shannon used the word mediated. There's mediated divorce, too. What's the distinction here?
Sure. The distinction is a mediator is a trained person who is qualified as a neutral to help parties reach a resolution. That is what a mediation agreement is. We sit together with a mediator, we resolve our issues, hopefully, and get to the end goal.
But the mediator isn't the advocate.
No, mediators are not advocates for other parties. By definition, a mediator needs to remain neutral. They cannot advocate for one party or the other. Mediators are available in any type of divorce situation that parties encounter, whether it's the more kind of traditional adversarial divorce where people are using the courtroom as a fail-safe when they can't reach a resolution, or mediators can even be used in our collaborative divorce model. And so collaborative divorce, as Shannon was describing, may not need the use of a mediator because at the outset, the parties are saying, hey, I agree that we are going to freely exchange information because we have the shared goal of getting to the end of this process without needing to go to the courtroom. So since we have that shared goal of not going to the courtroom, if you need a piece of paper, if you need information, if we need answers on what property is worth, we're going to jointly retain experts and work together to get that information. So again, mediators can be used in any situation, but they're not a designated or always used professional in the collaborative divorce model.
When we were talking about having this discussion for our show, Main Street, you mentioned a book that's just out. It's titled Our Happy Divorce, How Ending Our Marriage Brought Us Closer Together. And it's by Nikki DiBartolo and Benjamin Heldfond. DiBartolo is a well-known name in the San Francisco area because I think Eddie used to – he had a troubled legal past of his own, but he used to own a football team. This issue here, it takes two to make a marriage. It takes two to break it is one of the, I suppose – if you would, phrases that makes a collaborative divorce sort of a useful
sure.
approach.
Sure. And I think that's just it. I mean, in the book and the couple who wrote it, they talk a lot about that part of their process, and they weren't a collaborative divorce per se, but they did have a lot of the same kind of hallmarks. Part of their process was recognizing that it does take two and taking some responsibility for whatever got them to the end of the marriage point. and taking some personal responsibility for making the divorce and post-divorce life as smooth as possible, especially for their child. So, I mean, this process certainly does have some of those same hallmarks that got to take some recognition and some ownership of how this is going to look. And if both parties are going in, whether it's a traditional collaborative divorce or not, going in with the goal of trying to keep things peaceful and trying to take ownership of that along the way, it can make the process a lot smoother. And we can talk more about this too, but I think people a lot of times think about or talk about the financial cost of divorce, and divorce can be very expensive in some cases. I think the couple who wrote this book, they also sort of hit on the emotional cost of divorce, which is maybe under-discussed or under-recognized, and part of the collaborative process is keeping an eye out for that as well, especially when there are kids involved, but even when it's a purely financial case, people have emotional ties to that too and what got them to their divorce, you know, if there are affairs, things of that nature. So the collaborative process is really, I think, more careful to look out for people's emotion and the emotional taxation that can be caused by a traditionally litigated divorce, and is more careful to protect against that by keeping people on a peaceful path if they can.
Kimberly, the firm you belong to, Parvey Larson and McLean Family Law, includes obviously divorce. When somebody comes to you and says, we're interested in dissolving our marriage, is collaborative divorce what you bring up, or do they bring it up? Who initiates that conversation?
At this juncture, it's usually something that I bring up, and I'll be very clear, collaborative divorce is not a model that is appropriate in all divorce situations.
When is it not?
I'll say collaborative divorce would not necessarily be my go-to recommendation in a divorce situation where there are claims of, you know, abuse or unfair power dynamics or, you know, disproportionate abilities to be transparent. One of the hallmarks of a collaborative divorce process is the free exchange of information. And if a wife needs, I'm just going to, you know, be generic here and just give an example. If a wife needs access to financial information, does she have the faith that the husband will, you know, cooperate and freely share that information? If there's concerns either way of a spouse freely sharing information, then the collaborative process may not be the most appropriate in that instance too.
Shannon, in a collaborative divorce process, does each, you know, the husband and wife in the traditional sense, do each person has an attorney, an advocate?
Each person does.
So the attorneys are kind of collaborating too here, aren't they?
That's true. And that's part of the reason that to be able to do this process, attorneys have to go through a special training to make that happen as well. And the attorneys talk about it a lot as a paradigm shift, because it sort of is, or it very much is. Traditional attorneys, divorce attorneys, are adversarial. It's an adversarial system. There's a plaintiff and a defendant, and that's sort of what ends up on TV, what people see and hear about the most. So when we are in a collaborative role, wearing the collaborative hat, the attorneys are working together. It doesn't mean that we have to be the best of friends or that everything is always smooth sailing. There can be speed bumps along the way, but the attorneys are working toward the same goals of sharing information, getting the professionals involved what they need to help this family through. So we are sort of trained as well to work with one another and share information that is necessary to do.
Family law is, of course, a major way attorneys make a living. But this is something relatively new here, at least to my eye, the Collaborative Divorce Practice Group. Kimberly, does that mean that more and more attorneys are kind of getting on board that this is an option?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. To be designated as a collaborative law divorce attorney, there is specialized training that the attorney is required to go through. There's continuing education credits associated with it, and there is a roster that is maintained. And if people are interested in learning more about the collaborative law process, they're free to contact any of the attorneys that are rostered as in our collaborative law group here that practice regularly in the Fargo-Moorhead area.
So, Shannon, can you not just call yourself a collaborative practice attorney, or do you have to be certified in some way?
It's not exactly a certification, but sort of. There is training required to be a member of the North Dakota Collaborative Divorce Group. Other states have their own version. We're all under the umbrella of an international organization, in fact. So there is training required to be able to practice collaboratively, which may sound kind of funny because it doesn't mean that the skills can't be used in a traditional divorce. You know, Kim and I were discussing this earlier today as well. The training we've received does bleed into our regular practice, too, and certainly attorneys can use some of these same skills in a traditionally litigated divorce. But to practice and be a member of the collaborative divorce group, you are required to go through that specialized training.
And is this available across the state of North Dakota then?
It is. One of the struggles that the group has had is just that. We are in a relatively rural state. The majority of our collaborative practitioners right now are still out of Fargo-Moorhead area, but we are gaining a base in Grand Forks. We have a few members out in Bismarck and Minot, so we certainly would like to see this spread statewide and become more of a regular practice for folks.
So how much might a collaborative divorce cost, at least in comparison with a contested divorce, Kimberly?
Sure. And again, we get this question a lot because one of the hallmarks, again, of the collaborative divorce process, when people hear about it at the offset, it's okay, so husband has an attorney, wife has an attorney, we have a divorce coach, oh, we might have a financial specialist, oh, we have children, maybe we have a child specialist that's involved too to help us with this. We have, I've just ticked off maybe six different people that are involved.
Sounds like the stuff you have to go through to get married.
right. And so when you compare that to, well, if we just do this the old, traditional old-fashioned way, you have an attorney and I have an attorney. That sure sounds cheaper because there's less cooks in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But truthfully, when you break down the facts and when we start to look at cases that have come out of the collaborative divorce process, the statistics are showing us that it's far cheaper because those professionals that I ticked off, the mental health coach or the divorce coach or the child specialist, the financial specialist, they're jointly retained. They're working with both husband and wife. There's not two of them involved. And the people that are in the process are there to get you to the end at a mutually agreed upon point. So our statistics are showing that even with these multiple professionals that are involved, the costs are far cheaper. The financial costs are far cheaper for parties to go through this process, in addition to, as Shannon mentioned before, the emotional costs, because the emotions are being addressed by professionals. There is the child specialist who is a psychologist or mental health professional that is actually addressing those issues rather than mom or dad coming to talk to Shannon and me. And as much as we love talking to our clients, we're not counselors. We're here to help you through the process and we will be as sympathetic as possible, but we're not best suited to help address, emotional needs of clients.
There's also a time element here as well. Does a collaborative divorce or one that involves mediation take less time than a contested divorce? I mean, you don't have to secure a court date, do you?
That's right. And, that's one of the concerns people may sometimes have is, well, if there's not a court date hanging over us or a judge who's keeping tabs on what we're doing, couldn't this take a lot longer? But again, the couples who decide to enroll, so to speak, in this process, they are signing up with the same goal of getting things done.
They're halfway there to begin with.
That's exactly right. And so they are both motivated to share what needs to be shared. And I think in both collaborative and in our traditional practice, agreements are people who can reach agreements. Those cases happen much faster and typically much cheaper.
Are judges pleased to see this development?
They are. Some are not quite sure what to think about it because it is still relatively new. It's been around now since 1990, but in North Dakota, still much newer than that. And it's taking some time to gain traction. But judges, in my experience, are always happy to see, especially in family law, any kind of alternative dispute resolution process, any way to help families keep the decision-making in their own hands and not have a judge have to decide it for them, because the judges will tell you themselves they just cannot know your family like you know your family. There's no way. And this is nice to be able to help have a way for couples to be able to figure things out on their own, hopefully.
Kimberly, what is the job of a judge when dealing with a collaborative divorce agreement? Is it simply to sign the decree? Is there an evaluative process?
I can't speak for what judges do, but generally judges are required to ensure that the judgments that they sign off on are, you know, fair and equitable. And, you know, generally when a judge receives a stipulated or agreed upon marital termination agreement from a husband and wife, they will contain all the provisions about finances, children, whatever is applicable in that situation, along with generally the statement that the parties want this judgment or this stipulation to be entered, and they themselves find it to be fair and equitable. So my assumption is that the judge, of course, reviews everything, but he or she will have that peace of mind in knowing that this document that comes to me has been handled with the utmost of care with multiple professionals and the husband and wife who deem this to be the most fair and equitable situation given their circumstances.
And so a divorce might not end with something that's handed down from the bench, but might be an email saying the decree has been signed.
That's exactly how we get a lot of our divorce judgments. We just get an email notification in our inbox that says the court has reviewed it, and here is the electrically signed document, and here you go.
Are collaborative divorces ever denied? I know this is a relatively new practice, but are there potential problems?
It has happened once and only once that I know of, not a case that was handled here in Fargo, in fact, but there was a practitioner who said a judge had a concern about, I believe it was the parenting time schedule and perhaps the feasibility of that for the parties. So that case, to my knowledge, ended up with a judge saying, I have some concerns about A, B, and C provisions, and sent it back to the parties to sort of tweak a little more. I do believe it ended up being an agreement was entered ultimately and confirmed by the judge, but they do always have that oversight. If they look at an agreement and there is something that doesn't seem like it's quite workable or not within the bounds of the law, they're able to kick it back. But that's certainly a risk in any agreement reached in a divorce context. But typically, that's not the outcome.
Are there changes to state law that you'd like to see to better accommodate the dissolution of marriage and perhaps help collaborative agreements increase?
That's a great question.
Yeah,
At this moment, you know, rather than fill you with empty airspace, I can't say that I can think of anything that jumps to mind. Our collaborative law is written into our law. There's provisions and rules of court for it. What I think I would hope most, more than anything, is just for people to be aware that when you go through the divorce process, it does not have to be adversarial. It does not have to take place in the courtroom. You can regain control of the outcome, and you can do it on your own terms and keep things as amicable as possible.
Well, that is the, I suppose, often the stumbling block, because marriage is an emotional contract of sorts, and then the dissolution of it inevitably involves some emotional entanglement as well.
That's true. And I think, again, I keep going back to when there are kids involved, but especially when there are children involved. And the book touches on this, too, needing to find a way to have kids' voices be heard sometimes if they're of age to do so, or how to keep kids first and put their interests first. And another nice thing about the collaborative process is, again, it has an option to involve a child specialist, a child psychologist type person who can, outside of the parties and their attorneys, speak with children or involve children and kind of get their input to really help a family develop a creative way to make things work for their children as well. The collaborative process has a lot of options for creativity that maybe would not be there if you were in a litigation setting.
Well, people should Google collaborative divorce and perhaps consider looking at the book, Our Happy Divorce, How Ending Our Marriage Brought Us Closer Together. And Shannon Parvey and Kimberly Larson with Parvey Larson and McLean Family Law, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezerin.
Hear how Spanish became the world's second most spoken language.
It has a reputation as an easy language to learn. partly because it's easy to pick up the rules because the spellings are very uniform.
And get tips for seeing Spain for the first time, even in the heat of summer.
So if you don't mind the heat, it's a good time to go. The crowds are a little bit smaller.
A siesta, it's a necessity in the south of Spain.
It's all coming up pronto on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Over the last few weeks, Tom Ezern's Plainsfolk essays have had a common character, the lightning rod salesman. Tom is a professor of history, and back in the day, the lightning rod salesman was a topic of humor and anger. Today, his essay is titled Lynching the Lightning Rod Man.
The lightning rod man drove up to a farmhouse and, espying a boy outside, said to the lad, "Is that your father lying there in the shade, sonny?" "No, sir. Pa's away. And me and Ma is the only ones to home. That's a dead book agent. Do you want to sell Ma anything?" "Thunder, no." And the lightning rod man beat his retreat. Well, that was the joke circulating in our papers in 1880, a time when farm folk were fed up with the drummers who fanned out from the liveries in town to hawk their dubious wares to consumers in the country. "First the piano harp man who did a good business," recounted the Jamestown Alert in 1900. "Then the fanning mill man who did still better. Now the range men have eclipsed the others. The nursery stock man is headed this way. And methinks if our eyesight were a little better, we could see the lightning rod man coming over the hill." "Any good shooting on your farm?" inquired a hunter of a farmer. "Splendid," was the reply. "There's a lightning rod man down in the clover meadow, a cloth peddler at the house, a book agent out in the barn, and two tramps down in the stockyard. Climb right over the fence, young man, load both barrels and sail in." Newspapermen not only delighted to print such exchange items as that one, but also editorialized on the shadiness of lightning rod reps. Sometimes they were clever about it. "The lightning rod man must be allowed a good profit," said the Bismarck Tribune in 1880, "for when he sells out his business, he can never get much for goodwill." Others were more direct. "It would appear that the days of the voluble and ubiquitous lightning rod man are numbered," the editor of the Bottineau Pioneer announced optimistically in 1888. "Science is against him." Reports from neighboring Minnesota were, if anything, even more adverse. In 1892, three lightning rod agents were arrested in Buffalo for, the press reported, practicing a big fraud on farmers. The case collapsed when the judge instructed the jury with a directed verdict of not guilty. 5 years later, press reports popped up that Belgrade in Minnesota was the scene of a lynching bee, the object of which was a lightning rod agent who has gained much unfavorable notoriety in the last few days. Subsequent reports revealed that there had been no lynching, only that there had been some swindling and an angry gathering of farmers. Local citizens who were taken in by salesmen were subject to ridicule. "One of the most influential citizens of Benson County," announced the Devil's Lake editor in 1903, "was roped in by a lightning rod man at Chautauqua this week." Then in Galesburg in 1910, a correspondent reported that George Gagnon of Page had been seen passing through town with a load on. That is, the auto was heavily loaded with the lightning rod man and his paraphernalia. The editor was puzzled in that Mr. Gagnon had never been known to indulge in anything stronger than strawberry pop. With all this negative publicity, you would think it would have been hard, impossible, to sell lightning rods in North Dakota. And yet most every farm soon sported them. How did that happen? I think I can tell you next week.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with the author of a new book about the reach of slavery before the Civil War, Minnesota's connections to the slave trade. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Williston State College is going to be doing some extensive renovations to Stevens Hall, which houses the music program and a health and wellness center. It'll be done through a P3 concept, meaning private-public partnership. Williston State College President Dr. John Miller says P3 was chosen because the legislature hasn't funded many renovations or new building projects on college campuses.
In fact, the new building projects that they funded, you can count on one hand. So we had a pretty good idea that our project just wasn't going to rise to the, it wasn't going to be the cream that was on top of the milk, and we needed to get things done.
Miller says the project will be directed by Johnson Controls. He says the project includes new HVAC systems, lighting upgrades, and other projects to bring the facility up to the Americans with Disabilities Act compliance.
It's a lease, but it's funded by a bond payment. So the college will have a payment schedule, and there'll be X amount of dollars that we'll pay each year. And I think the term on this is like 22 years. The nice thing about it is there's a guarantee that at the end of the lease or the bond period, the equipment and SIP and systems and technology will be up to speed.
The project has a $6 million price tag. Cass County Sheriff Jesse Johnner says he wishes the outcome would have been different. The owner of a horse put the animal down after Johnner, an investigator, offered to remove the horse from the property. The department was on the property along I-29 near Argusville twice with search warrants, responding to complaints that the horse appeared to be in distress.
After the execution of the search warrant, we made contact with the horse owner, and we kind of somewhat gave him an ultimatum, if you want to call it that, and said, hey, we need to make some changes up here. And if you don't, we're probably going to, need to come back to the property and look at potentially seizing the horse at that point. And contacting him back, he indicated that he was going to put the horse down.
A veterinarian checked on the horse during one of the searches and concluded the horse was in good health, but expressed concern the hay may not contain enough nutrients. Johnner says he also told the property owner the fencing was not adequate to keep the horse off the interstate. A horse owned by the man got onto the highway in December and was hit by a car. Another horse who broke free and was also struck had to be euthanized. The state's attorney's office will determine whether charges will be filed. And the Jamestown Fire Department working on replacing a ladder truck. The city had one such truck, but it was paid for by the state of North Dakota because of the state hospital in James River Correctional Center. But that truck is gone, and the city will have to buy the new one. The replacement truck would cost around $1 million. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Dr. Christopher P. Lehman. He is a professor of African American Studies at St. Cloud State University. He joins us by phone to discuss his new book. Thanks for joining us, Christopher.
Thanks for inviting me.
The book is Slavery's Reach. It's published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. It's a finalist for a Minnesota Book Award, and it tells some intriguing stories about the connection of the state of Minnesota with the slave trade. Christopher, how did this book come to be?
Well, it came about, I'd say, about 4 years ago when I started trying to find ways that were documented in which Minnesota was connected to the country's slavery economy. And the documents that were most accessible to me were real estate deeds, because I could go to any county recorder office and look up the deeds. So what I did for the next 4 years was to go to counties that were primarily along the Mississippi River, since that would have been a direct geographical connection to the South. And of those Minnesota counties, I wanted to make sure that they were organized before 1865, since slavery would have been legal before 1865. And I went through all the deeds, and I wrote down the name of every Southerner that was listed on a deed, and I wrote down the name of where in the South that person lived. And then at the end of each day at one of these recorder offices, I would go home, and I would look up lists of slaveholders from those particular counties. And if the name on the deed was in the list of the names of slaveholders, then I knew that the deed was the paper trail. in which there was a recording of a monetary transaction from a plantation in the South to the hands of a Minnesotan. And what I wanted to do with my book was to show that even though slaves were not physically present in Minnesota in great number, they didn't have to be in order for Minnesota to benefit financially from slavery.
So when Minnesota was a territory, it became a state in 1858, and then not long after that, there's the Civil War, largely over the issue of slavery, among other things. But the state was, or the territory, was a destination for investors, I take it.
That's right. Southerners would come to Minnesota to invest in real estate. Some of them were slaveholders who wanted to diversify their investment portfolios and not be totally reliant on the plantation economy. But there were other Southerners who were the sons of slaveholders who were definitely wealthy because of the slaves that their parents held. But they themselves weren't interested in becoming slaveholders, but they used that money that they received from their parents to invest in real estate in Minnesota. And they would invite Southerners who were slaveholders to buy land from them in Minnesota. So they were able to benefit from other people's generation of money through slavery without having to own slaves themselves.
Well, some of those landowners or Minnesotans by tradition are prominent in our history. There are counties named after them. There are all kinds of places named after them. Give us a sense of who these people are.
Yes. Well, the people who we would consider to be Minnesota's founding fathers, like Henry Rice and Henry Sibley and John Prince, all of them were fur traders, and the Minnesota fur trade at one point was run by the American Fur Company. And the American Fur Company was a company that was co-owned by three slaveholders down in St. Louis, Missouri. So whenever Rice and Sibley and Prince were working for the fur trade, they were getting paid by these Missouri slaveholders. So whatever money that Rice and Sibley and Prince used to develop Minnesota was tainted by slavery.
Christopher Lehman is a professor of African American Studies at St. Cloud State University. We're talking about his new book, Slavery's Reach, published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press, talking about the influence of slaveholders in the founding of our state and the development of it. Christopher, was there a consensus opinion among settlers of the Minnesota Territory before statehood in 1858 about the legitimacy of slavery?
Well, they were convinced that a slavery economy just would not work in Minnesota, meaning that it would not be conducive to try to have large plantations in Minnesota. The soil won't cooperate, and neither would the weather. However, it certainly was just fine, and it was perfectly legal for slaveholders and Minnesotans to do business with each other as long as they weren't selling people. So Minnesotans were perfectly fine with being almost totally dependent in some communities on this money from Southern slaveholders. Now, there were a few people who might have been worried about just how influential the South would be through their money in Minnesota. But primarily, Minnesota's communities, especially along the Mississippi River, welcomed the money that came with Southern visitors, especially Southern tourists, during the summer months. And they would just look the other way, or they would rationalize that since they weren't the ones doing the enslaving, it was perfectly fine to take money from the people who were.
So a steamboat comes up the Mississippi and lands at maybe Stillwater eventually. They're investors or tourists, and would they not occasionally bring a slave along with them? And if they did, what was the status of that person in the territory of Minnesota?
Well, when Minnesota was a free territory and a free state, then legally speaking, that slave would become free upon arriving in Minnesota. However, in 1857, the Supreme Court had the Dred Scott decision, which said that every territory can legally have slavery. And Minnesota was still a territory back then. It would not be a state for another 14 months.
And Minnesota had a role in that Dred Scott decision, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, because Dred Scott was kept in Minnesota at Fort Snelling. And so it was based on him being in a free area that when he was taken back to Missouri, he sued, saying that he should be free since he was in a free area, but the Supreme Court ultimately said no. Oh, and the person that Dred Scott sued was John Sanford, who was one of the three partners of Choteau and Company. This is connected in all sorts of ways.
Well, this Supreme Court decision, the Dred Scott decision, in effect, according to your work, legalized slavery in all territories, including Minnesota, until statehood 14 months later.
That's right. So during that spring and summer of 1857, when Southerners brought slaves to Minnesota, they were still slaves legally. They did not become free during that 14-month period.
Now, you mentioned that Dred Scott had been at Fort Snelling. Was there a unique status of officers who would bring slaves to a fort and where they were serving in Minnesota Territory?
Well, what happened with Fort Snelling was that after it was built, there was a contingent of military officers from Missouri who were sent to Fort Snelling, but as an incentive for the officers to come here, the federal government said that if they wanted to bring one or two slaves with them, they could, and that the government would give them a stipend to take care of them. But this was already after there had been two federal laws passed to say that slavery could not be in Minnesota. So the federal government was disobeying its own law for the sake of having a strong military presence at Fort Snelling.
Well, when these people from the South would stop at St. Peter or St. Paul or Stillwater, and they would come into a hotel, they might have a slave with them. What happened to the slave?
Well, in the registers that I've looked at, the people would always be signed as a group. So if an entire family came, the head of the family, typically a man, would sign his name and then and wife or and family plus servant or plus nurse. They would never use the word slave. They would always use some other kind of term, but they would all be signed in together. So if they all stayed in the same room, then I would assume that the nurse or the servant would have just had to sleep on the floor.
So for the most part, people would see someone of color in a town like that, and they would have to most likely assume that that was a slave, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And Minnesotans were aware that Southerners who were coming to Minnesota for weeks and months at a time were wealthy, and that they were wealthy because they were slaveholders. So there was certainly awareness of that happening in Minnesota. And there were some people who lived in those tourist towns who did not like that. And at least in the Minneapolis area, whenever there would be a steamboat that would disembark, there would be a crowd of people who were anti-slavery who would boo whenever the Southerners would get off the boat.
Was there anything like an underground railroad for slaves in Minnesota river towns like the Twin Cities?
No, not that far up north. There definitely was a point in Stillwater that was part of an underground railroad that would help slaves get into Canada. But in the rest of the state, I don't think so.
Let's talk a bit about the economics of slavery here for a moment. What was the relative value of a slave during this time that we're talking about?
Well, it depended on age and it depended on gender. So typically a male slave who was between the age of 20 and the age of 35 would be the most valuable and probably $800 to $1,000 each. A woman of the same age might be $100 less, but could also be the same value, especially if that woman could produce children, because by giving birth to slaves, that saves the master from having to buy a slave.
So they're symbols of wealth.
A young adult,
yeah.
Right. So a young adult would be $800 to $1,000. A teenager or a slave in their 30s and 40s would be $600 to $800 each. And then someone who's grade school age, and then someone who is in their 50s and 60s would be worth $400 to $600. And then the elderly in their 60s and early 70s would be worth $200, and so would babies and toddlers. And once you get elderly to the point of not being able to walk or see well, then he wouldn't be worth more than $50, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a prevalent attitude about service in general at that time. I mean, the people of means would have servants. In the North, maybe they wouldn't be people of color, but they would be family servants. And for that matter, Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, their family had a servant, a black boy, I think, at that time, a young man, very young man, about, I think, Samuel's age. So did it cost less to have a slave than a servant who was of your own race?
Well, certainly if you had a slave, then you wouldn't have to pay that person a salary or a wage, but you would be responsible for the clothing and the feeding and the sheltering of that slave, but you could use the bare minimum of that to save whatever money you wanted to save. But when you're employing a civilian or a free person, then you do have to negotiate with them, and you have to give them a payment that they're going to want to receive in order for them to do the work that you want them to do.
Yeah, and there might be some work no one would want to do, and of course they would have the right to just walk away if they didn't want to. So,
right.
Is it likely that other states with similar connections to Southern slaveholders have similar problematic histories, particularly along rivers?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. Whenever I would find names of slaveholders, I would also look at newspaper accounts to see if there were reports about them. And I would very often come across newspaper accounts of Southerners traveling to Minnesota, but because they're on their way to Iowa, too. And those reports talk about Southerners investing both in Minnesota and in Iowa on the same trip. So certainly Iowa has that history, and I wouldn't be surprised if Wisconsin did too.
You've written several pieces for Minnesota History Magazine. One was Black Cloud, The Struggle of St. Cloud's African-American Community, back around the turn of the 20th century and before. And The Contemplation of Our Righteousness was another one, Vigilante Acts Against African-Americans in Southwest Minnesota. Now, Minnesota has had and has a reputation as a relatively progressive state. Was it less receptive than other places in the North to African-American resettlement after the Civil War?
Well, I think it depended on the area, especially the politics of the area. For example, in St. Cloud, there had historically been dominance of the Democrat Party. And back then, in the 1850s at least, and earlier, the Democratic Party was very pro-slavery, and then afterward, very much pro-segregation. And if that's the politics of the community, then that's not going to attract African-Americans there, because at the time, African-Americans tended to vote Republican, since the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and the party of Emancipation Proclamation and so forth. So if the politics were more Republican, then that's where African-Americans would go. So that alone would account for why there would be a greater presence in the Twin Cities versus in St. Cloud.
And yet there aren't significant pockets of African-Americans outside of the Twin Cities, are there, during that time?
No. No, there aren't. And the thing about St. Cloud, especially, is that the African-American population was those few slaves who came with slaveholders who decided to stay in Minnesota permanently. They were very few in number. Most of them were just here temporarily on a vacation. But there were some who were here full time. But when the Civil War broke out, Southerners returned to the South with their slaves. And that would cause a drain of African-American populations in Minnesota. So the population of St. Cloud ultimately went down to zero during the Civil War. And there would be pockets of time when they would return, but then they would leave again. But it's only been since 1883 that there has been at least one African-American living in St. Cloud.
That said, northern states, and we're talking about Minnesota in particular here, have histories of virulent racism, regardless of the fact whether they were ever slaveholder states or ever had a significant population of African Americans. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because you had to have communities with resources to help people who were coming out of slavery. And Minnesota just did not have those resources very much outside of the Twin Cities. And then you had states that were in the West and the Northwest that were extremely hostile to the presence of African Americans, whether they were free or slave. In Iowa, in Utah, and other places, there were laws that said that there was not supposed to be any slavery, but we don't want any free African Americans living here either. Fortunately, Minnesota was never such a state. There was never any state law that said that no free African American could live in Minnesota. But it would be extremely difficult for African Americans to come to Minnesota and then settle in the communities, again, especially if some of them had Democratic leanings.
And we're reminded in 2020 that in 1920 there was a savage lynching in Duluth. Three African-American men were murdered by a mob.
Right. That'll be 100 years ago this June when that happened. And when I wrote the other articles about St. Cloud and about Montevideo, I wanted to point out through those articles that Duluth was not an isolated incident. It wasn't an anomaly. Whatever happened in Duluth could have happened anywhere because there was anti-African-American sentiment all over the state. It was just in Duluth where it reached its most violent point.
Well, you mentioned in your Minnesota Magazine history piece, the contemplation of our righteousness, vigilante acts against African-Americans in Southwest Minnesota, the year 1903. Implicated these kinds of issues in Montevideo and Olivia. So there's plenty of history to comb through, I guess.
Absolutely. There are quite a few stories that are untold, and I think that's what makes Minnesota such an interesting place for me to do research, because the things that I've been able to find in my 18 years of being here have been just very eye-opening, because I had my own ideas about Minnesota before I got here, that it was a free place, and that slavery didn't have that much of an influence because there just weren't that many African Americans. That was my mindset coming into the state. But the more that I read and the more that I found on my own, the more that I learned that I was just plain wrong.
Well, thank you for spending a little time with us. We're just reminded that February is Black History Month, and this is important history. Dr. Christopher Lehman is a professor of African American Studies at St. Cloud State University and the author of the new book, Slavery's Reach, published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
Decoded Ape Book is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Barb Gravel, host of the television show Prairie Musicians on Prairie Public, Oakland.
Break out these chains, let's burn it down.
Anchorage.
You're drowning, let me know, cause I've never been much of a swimmer.
New Orleans.
That's crispy treats and noodles, home alone, Macaulay Culkin. Cause sometimes, I need more space than sauce can give me, more sky than God provides me.
Columbus, Georgia. What do these places have in common? They're some of the hometowns of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest winners. The 2020 edition is on, and we'd love to see someone from North Dakota, Eastern Montana, or Northwest Minnesota win it all this year. So Prairie Musicians over 18, sound check, and then film yourself performing an original song in front of the Tiny Desk of your choice. Then upload it onto YouTube and do a little dance for luck, because it'll be judged by a distinguished panel that includes multiple Grammy winner Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. The winner will perform at the iconic Tiny Desk in D.C., and embark on a 10-city U.S. concert tour with NPR Music. Entries must be in by March 30th. Just go to npr.org/tinydeskcontest for complete rules and to upload your clip.
Are you ready?
We're so thrilled to welcome the winner of the Tiny Desk Contest!
The 2020 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. Go for it, Prairie Musicians!
This is Dakota Datebook for February 26th. The abortion debate often gets cleanly split between two camps, pro-life and pro-choice. However, things aren't always clear-cut. In 1992, an abortion case from North Dakota received national attention, including an article appearing in the New York Times on this date. It all started when Martina Graywind, a 28-year-old woman from Fargo, was arrested for inhaling paint fumes. It was soon discovered she was pregnant, inhaling fumes in part to induce a miscarriage. She had expressed desire for an abortion, but could not afford one. Subsequently, she was charged with reckless endangerment to a fetus, and on February 10th, without any legal assistance, she pleaded guilty. Later, an attorney took her case, and she withdrew the plea. A pro-life group called the Lambs of Christ began talking to Graywind while she was in jail, trying to convince her not to have an abortion. They offered her food, shelter, medical care, and money if she would have the baby. They said they had five couples willing to adopt. They paid for her bail, but 9 hours after her release, she was arrested again for sniffing paint. She pleaded guilty and was sent to the state mental hospital. The state's attorney ordered that she complete 30 days there or to do time in jail, but a judge ruled she could be released for a medical and/or psychological appointment. That created an opportunity for the abortion. The Lambs of Christ renewed their efforts to prevent the procedure, such as trying to make Graywind's brother her legal guardian. But on February 22nd, she was driven to the Fargo Women's Health Clinic, where the doctor confirmed Martina Graywind's desire to have an abortion. The procedure took place, even as a growing circle of protesters gathered outside the clinic. April 10th, the prosecutor dropped the reckless endangerment charges, saying it was no longer worth the time or expense to prosecute her. The Lambs of Christ intended to sue North Dakota, saying the state pressured Graywind to get the abortion in order to have the charges dropped, but that argument eventually burned itself out as well. The case does sit as an example of how a person can be unwillingly thrown into the middle of a hotly contested issue, an issue that remains very much alive 30 years later. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next Morning Edition, will climate change concerns drive more voters to the polls in November?
When you look under the hood, what you notice is that the shift is primarily among Democrats, not Republicans.
Also, we'll visit an exhibit that elevates daily life in Paris into fine art.
These are casual moments. They're banal. They're intimate.
It could be any of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Listen for all kinds of stories on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thursday on Main Street, our Bill Thomas will share his highlights from the North Dakota Poetry Out Loud Championship. Then we'll hear from NPR's Bob Boylan as he visits with our Eric Dethridge to discuss the Tiny Desk Concert Contest. And Sue Balcom will join us to discuss things she's learned by watching the Great British Bake Off TV show. And then we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of events. That's all coming up on Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.